yen bills and counted them as she stood there. She was very adept at counting, her beautiful, slim fingers moving swiftly. She finished counting, returned the bills to the envelope, and put the envelope in her cloth bag. She showed Ushikawa an even bigger, warmer smile than before, as if nothing could have made her happier than to meet him. Ushikawa tried to imagine what connection this woman could have with Bat, passing along the material, receiving payment. That was perhaps the only role she played. After the small woman had left, Ushikawa stared at the door for the longest time. She had shut the door behind her, but there was still a strong sense of her in the room. Maybe in exchange for leaving a trace of herself behind, she had taken away a part of Ushikawa's soul. He could feel that new void within his chest. Why did this happen? He wondered, finding it odd. And what could it possibly mean? After about 10 minutes, he finally took the materials out of the envelopes, which had been sealed with several layers of adhesive tape. The inside was stuffed with a jumble of printouts, photocopies, and original documents. Ushikawa didn't know how Bat had accomplished it, but he had certainly come up with a lot of material in such a short time. As always, the man did an impressive job. Still, faced with that bundle of documents, Ushikawa was hit by a deep sense of impotence. No matter how much he might rustle around in it, would he ever arrive anywhere? Or would he spend a small fortune just to wind up with a stack of waste paper? The sense of powerlessness he experienced was so deep that he could stare as much as he wanted into the well and never get a glimpse of its bottom. Everything Ushikawa could see was covered in a gloomy twilight, like an intimation of death. Perhaps this was due to something that woman left behind, he thought. Or perhaps due to something she took away with her. Somehow, though, Ushikawa recovered his strength. He patiently went through the stack of materials until evening, copying the information he felt was important into a notebook, organizing it under different categories. By concentrating on this, he was able to dispel the mysterious listlessness that had grabbed hold of him. And by the time it grew dark and he switched on his desk lamp, Ushikawa was thinking that the information had been worth every yen he had paid for it. He began by reading through the material from the sports club. Aomame was a highly skilled trainer, popular with the members. Along with teaching general classes, she was also a personal trainer. Looking through the copies of the daily schedule, he could figure out when, where, and how she trained these private clients. Sometimes she trained them individually at the club. Sometimes she went to their homes. Among the names of her clients was a well-known entertainer and a politician. The dowager of the Willow House, Shizue Ogata, was her oldest client. Her connection with Shizue Ogata began not long after Aomame started working at the club 4 years earlier and continued until just before she disappeared. This was exactly the same period during which the two-story apartment building at the Willow House became a safe house for victims of domestic violence. Maybe it was a coincidence, but maybe not. At any rate, according to the records, their relationship appeared to have deepened over time. Perhaps a personal bond had grown between Aomame and the old dowager. Ushikawa's intuition sensed this. At first, it started out as the relationship between a sports club instructor and a client, but at a certain point, the nature of this relationship changed. As Ushikawa went through the business-like descriptions in chronological order, he tried to pinpoint that moment. Something happened that transformed their relationship beyond that of mere instructor and client. They formed a close personal relationship that transcended the difference in age and status. This may even have led to some secret emotional understanding between the two, a secret understanding that eventually led Aomame down the path to murder Leader at the Hotel Okura. Ushikawa's sense of smell told him so. But what was that path? And what secret understanding did they have? That was as far as Ushikawa's conjectures could take him. Most likely domestic violence was one factor in it. At first glance, this seemed to be a critical theme for the older woman. According to the records, the first time Shizue Ogata came in contact with Aomame was at a self-defense class. It wasn't very common for a woman in her 70s to take a self-defense class. Something connected with violence must have brought the old lady and Aomame together. Or maybe Aomame herself had been the victim of domestic violence, and Leader had committed domestic violence. Perhaps they found out about this and decided to punish him. But these were all simply hypotheses, and these hypotheses didn't square with the image Ushikawa had of Leader. Certainly people, no matter who they are, have something hidden deep down inside, and Leader was a deeper person than most. He was, after all, the driving force behind a major religious organization. Wise and intelligent, he also had depths no one else could access. But say he really had committed domestic violence, would these acts have been so significant to these women that when they learned of them, they planned out a meticulous assassination? One of them giving up her identity, the other risking her social standing? One thing was for sure. The murder of Leader was not carried out on a whim. Behind it stood an unwavering will, a clear-cut, unclouded motivation, and an elaborate system, a system that had been meticulously crafted using a great deal of time and money. The problem was that there was no concrete proof to back up his conjectures. What Ushikawa had before him was nothing more than circumstantial evidence based on theories, something that Occam's razor could easily prune away. At this stage, he couldn't report anything to Sakigake. Still, he knew he was onto something. There was a certain smell to it, a distinctive texture. All the elements pointed in a single direction. Something to do with domestic violence made the dowager direct Aomame to kill Leader and then hide her away. Indirectly, all the information Bat had provided him supported this conclusion. Plowing through the materials dealing with the witnesses took a long time. There were an enormous number of documents, most of them useless to Ushikawa. The majority of the materials were reports on what Aomame's family had contributed to the activities of the witnesses. As far as these documents were concerned, Aomame's family were earnest, devout followers. They had spent the better part of their lives propagating the religion's message. Her parents presently resided in Ichikawa, in Chiba Prefecture. In 35 years, they had moved twice, both times within Ichikawa. Her father, Takayuki Aomame, 58, worked in an engineering firm, while her mother, Yasuko, 56, wasn't employed. The couple's eldest son, Keiichi Aomame, 34, had worked in a small printing company in Tokyo after graduating from a prefectural high school in Ichikawa. But after 3 years, he quit the company and began working at the witnesses' headquarters in Odawara. There, he also worked in printing, making pamphlets for the religion, and was now a supervisor. 5 years earlier, he had married a woman who was also a member of the witnesses. They had two children and rented an apartment in Odawara. The record for the eldest daughter, Masumi Aomame, ended when she was 11. That was when she abandoned the faith. And the witnesses seemed to have no interest at all in anyone who had left the faith. To the witnesses, it was the same as if Masumi Aomame had died at age 11. After this, there wasn't a single detail about what sort of life she led, not even whether or not she was alive. In this case, Ashikawa thought, the only thing to do is visit the parents or the brother and ask them. Maybe they will provide me with some hint. From what he gathered from the documentary evidence, he didn't imagine they would be too pleased to answer his questions. Aomame's family, as far as Ushikawa could see, that is, were narrow-minded in their thinking, narrow-minded in the way they lived. They were people who had no doubt whatsoever that the more narrow-minded they became, the closer they got to heaven. To them, anyone who abandoned the faith, even a relative, was traveling down a wicked, defiled path. Who knows, maybe they didn't even think of them as relatives anymore. Had our mommy been the victim of domestic violence as a girl? Maybe she had, maybe she hadn't. Even if she had, her parents most likely would not have seen this as abuse. Ushikawa knew very well how strict members of the Witnesses were with their children. In many cases, this included corporal punishment. But would a childhood experience like that form such a deep wound that it would lead a person, after she grew up, to commit murder? This wasn't out of the realm of possibility, but Ushikawa thought it was pushing the limits of conjecture to an extreme. Carrying out a premeditated murder on one's own wasn't easy. It was dangerous, to begin with, and the emotional toll was enormous. If you got caught, the punishment was stiff. There had to be a stronger motivation behind it. Ushikawa picked up the sheaf of documents and carefully reread the details about Masumi Aomame's background up to age 11. Almost as soon as she could walk, she began accompanying her mother to proselytize. They went from door to door, handing out pamphlets, telling people about the judgment to come at the end of the world and urging them to join the faith. Joining meant you could survive the end of the world. After that, the heavenly kingdom would appear. A church member had knocked on Ushikawa's door any number of times. Usually it was a middle-aged woman wearing a hat or holding a parasol. Most wore glasses and stared fixedly at him with eyes like those of a clever fish. Often, she had a child along. Ushikawa pictured little Aomame trundling around from door to door with her mother. Aomame didn't attend kindergarten, but went into the local neighborhood municipal public elementary school in Ichikawa. And when she was in fifth grade, she withdrew from the Witnesses. It was unclear why she left. The Witnesses didn't record each and every reason a member renounced the faith. Whoever fell into the clutches of the devil could very well stay there. Talking about paradise and the path to get there kept members busy enough. The righteous had their own work to do and the devil his, a spiritual division of labor. In Ushikawa's brain, someone was knocking on a cheaply made plywood partition. "Mr. Ushikawa! Mr. Ushikawa!" the voice was yelling. Ushikawa closed his eyes and listened carefully. The voice was faint but persistent. "I must have overlooked something," he thought. "A critical fact must be written here somewhere, in these very documents. But I can't see it. The knock must be telling me this." Ushikawa turned again to the thick stack of documents, not just following what was written, but trying to imagine actual scenes in his mind. 3-year-old Aomame going with her mother as she spread the gospel door to door. Most of the time, people slammed the door in their faces. Next, she's in elementary school. She continues proselytizing. Her weekends are taken up entirely with propagating their faith. She doesn't have any time to play with friends. She might not even have had any friends. Most children in the Witnesses were bullied and shunned at school. Ushikawa had read a book on the Witnesses and was well aware of this. And at age 11, she left the religion. That must have taken a great deal of determination. Aomame had been raised in the faith and had it drummed into her since she was born. The faith had seeped into every fiber of her being, so she couldn't easily slough it off like changing clothes. That would mean she was isolated within the home. They wouldn't easily accept a daughter who had renounced the faith. For Aomame, abandoning the faith was the same as abandoning her family. When Aomame was 11, what in the world had happened to her? What could have made her come to that decision? The Ichikawa Municipal Elementary School. Ushikawa tried saying the name aloud. Something happened there. Something had most definitely happened. He inhaled sharply. "I've heard the name of that school before," he realized. "But where?" Ushikawa had no ties to Chiba Prefecture. He had been born in Urawa, a city inside Tama, and ever since he came to Tokyo to go to college, except for the time he lived in Chorin-kan in Kanagawa Prefecture, he had lived entirely within the 23 wards of Tokyo. He had barely set foot in Chiba Prefecture. Only once, as he recalled, when he went to the beach at Futsu. So why did the name of an elementary school in Ichikawa ring a bell? It took him a while to remember. He rubbed his misshapen head as he concentrated. He fumbled through the dark recesses of memory, as if sticking his hand deep down into mud. It wasn't so long ago that he first heard that name, very recently, in fact. Chiba Prefecture. Ichikawa Municipal Elementary School. Finally, he grabbed onto one end of a thin rope. Tango Kuwana. That's it. Tango Kuwana was from Ichikawa. And I think he attended a municipal public elementary school in town, too. Ushikawa pulled down from his document shelf the file on Tango. This was material he had compiled a few months back at the request of Sakigake. He flipped through the pages to confirm Tango's school record. His plump finger came to rest on Tango's name. It was just as he had thought. Masami Aomame had attended the same elementary school as Tango Kuwana. Based on their birth dates, they were probably in the same year in school. Whether they were in the same class or not would require further investigation, but there was a high probability they knew each other. Ushikawa put a Seven Stars cigarette in his mouth and lit up with his lighter. He had the distinct feeling that things were starting to fall into place. He was connecting the dots, and though he was unsure of what sort of picture would emerge, before long he should be able to see the outlines. "Miss Aomame, can you hear my footsteps?" "Probably not, since I'm walking as quietly as I can. But step by step, I'm getting closer. I'm a dull, silly tortoise, but I'm definitely making progress. Pretty soon, I'll catch sight of the rabbit's back. You can count on it." Ushikawa leaned back from his desk, looked up at the ceiling, and slowly let the smoke rise up from his mouth.
Chapter 8. Aomame. Not such a bad door. Except for the silent men who brought supplies every Tuesday afternoon, for the next 2 weeks, no one else visited Aomame's apartment. The man who claimed to be an NHK fee collector had insisted that he would be back. He had been determined, or at least that was the way it sounded to Aomame. But there hadn't been a knock on the door since. Maybe he was busy with another route. On the surface, these were quiet, peaceful days. Nothing happened. Nobody came by. The phone didn't ring. To be on the safe side, Tamaru called as little as possible. Aomame always kept the curtains closed, living as quietly as she could, so as not to attract attention. After dark, she turned on the bare minimum number of lights. Trying to stay as quiet as possible, she did strenuous workouts, mopped the floor every day, and spent a lot of time preparing meals. She asked for some Spanish language tapes and went over the lessons aloud. Not speaking for a long time makes the muscles around your mouth grow slack. She had to focus on moving her mouth as much as she could, and foreign language drills were good for that. Plus, Aomame had long fantasized about South America. If she could go anywhere, she would like to live in a small, peaceful country in South America, like Costa Rica. She would rent a small villa on the coast and spend the days swimming and reading. With the money she had stuffed in her bag, she should be able to live for 10 years there, if she watched her expenses. She couldn't see them chasing her all the way to Costa Rica. As she practiced Spanish conversation, Aomame imagined a quiet, peaceful life on the Costa Rican beach. Could Tango be a part of her life there? She closed her eyes and pictured the two of them sunbathing on a Caribbean beach. She wore a small black bikini and sunglasses and was holding Tango's hand. But a sense of reality, the kind that would move her, was missing from the picture. It was nothing more than an ordinary tourist brochure photo. When she ran out of things to do, she cleaned the pistol. She followed the manual and disassembled the Heckler & Koch, cleaned each part with a cloth and brush, oiled them, and then reassembled it. She made sure the action was smooth. By now she had mastered the operation, and the pistol felt like a part of her body. She would go to bed at 10, read a few pages in her book, and fall asleep. Al-Mame had never had trouble falling asleep. As she read, she would get sleepy. She would switch off the bedside lamp, rest her head on the pillow, and shut her eyes. With few exceptions, when she opened her eyes again, it was morning. Ordinarily, she didn't tend to dream much. Even if she did, she usually had forgotten most of the dream by the time she woke up. Sometimes faint scraps of her dream would get caught on the wall of her consciousness, but she couldn't retrace these fragments back to any coherent narrative. All that remained were small random images. She slept deeply, and the dream she did have came from a very deep place. Like fish that live at the bottom of the ocean, most of her dreams weren't able to float to the surface. Even if they did, the difference in water pressure would force a change in their appearance. But after coming to live in this hiding place, she dreamed every night. And these were clear, realistic dreams. She would be dreaming and wake up in the middle of a dream, unable to distinguish whether she was in the real world or the dream world. Al-Mame couldn't remember ever having had this experience before. She would look over at the digital clock beside her bed. The numbers would say 1:15, 2:37, or 4:07. She would close her eyes and try to fall asleep again, but it wasn't easy. The two different worlds were silently at odds within her, fighting over her consciousness, like the mouth of a river where the seawater and the fresh water flow in. "Not much I can do about it," she told herself. "I'm not even sure if this world with two moons in the sky is the real reality or not. So it shouldn't be so strange, should it? That in a world like this, if I fall asleep and dream, I find it hard to distinguish dream from reality. And let's not forget that I've killed a few men with my own hands. I'm being chased by fanatics who aren't about to give up, and I'm hiding out. How could I not be tense and afraid? I can still feel the sensation in my hands of having murdered somebody. Maybe I'll never be able to sleep soundly the rest of my life. Maybe that's the responsibility I have to bear, the price I have to pay." The dream she had, at least the one she could recall, fell into three set categories. The first was a dream about thunder. She is in a dark room with thunder roaring continuously. But there is no lightning, just like the night she murdered Leader. There is something in the room. Al-Mama is lying in bed, naked, and something is wandering about around her, slowly, deliberately. The carpet is thick, and the air lies heavy and still. The windowpane rattles slightly in the thunder. She is afraid. She doesn't know what is there in the room. It might be a person. Maybe it's an animal. Maybe it's neither one. Finally, though, whatever it is leaves the room. Not through the door, nor by the window. But still, its presence fades away until it has completely disappeared. She is alone now in the room. She fumbles for the light near her bed. She gets out of bed still naked and looks around the room. There is a hole in the wall opposite her bed, a hole big enough for one person to barely make it through. The hole isn't in a set spot. It changes shape and moves around. It shakes, it moves, it grows bigger, it shrinks, as if it's alive. Something left through that hole. She stares into the hole. It seems to be connected to something else, but it's too dark inside to see. A darkness so thick that it's as if you could cut it out and hold it in your hand. She is curious, but at the same time afraid. Her heart pounds a cold, distant beat. The dream ends there. The second dream took place on the shoulder of the Metropolitan Expressway. And here, too, she is totally nude. Caught in the traffic jam, people leer at her from their cars, shamelessly ogling her naked body. Most are men, but there are a few women, too. The people are staring at her less than ample breasts and her pubic hair and the strange way it grows, all of them evaluating her body. Some are frowning, some smiling wryly, others yawning. Others are staring intently at her, their faces blank. She wants to cover herself up, at least her breast and groin if she can. A scrap of cloth would do the trick, or a sheet of newspaper. But there is nothing around her she can pick up. And for some reason, she has no idea why, she can't move her arms. From time to time the wind blows, stimulating her nipples, rustling her pubic hair. On top of this, as if things couldn't get any worse, it feels like she is about to get her period. Her back feels dull and heavy, her abdomen hot. What should she do if, in front of all these people, she starts bleeding? Just then, the driver's side door of a silver Mercedes coupe opens, and a very refined middle-aged woman steps out. She's wearing bright-colored high heels, sunglasses, and silver earrings. She's slim, about the same height as Aomame. She wends her way through the backed-up cars, and when she comes over, she takes off her coat and puts it on Aomame. It's an eggshell-colored spring coat that comes down to her knees. It's light as a feather. It's simple but obviously expensive. The coat fits her perfectly, like it was made for her. The woman buttons it up for her, all the way to the top. "I don't know when I can return it to you. I'm afraid I might bleed on it," Aomame says. Without a word, the woman shakes her head, then weaves her way back through the cars to the Mercedes coupe. From the driver's side, it looks like she lifts her hand in a small wave to Aomame, but it may be an illusion. Wrapped in the light, soft spring coat, Aomame knows she is protected. Her body is no longer exposed to anyone's view. And right then, as if it could barely wait, a line of blood drips down her thigh. Hot, thick, heavy blood. But as she looks at it, she realizes it isn't blood. It's colorless. The third dream was hard to put into words. It was a rambling, incoherent dream without any setting. All that was there was a feeling of being in motion. Aomame was ceaselessly moving through time and space. It didn't matter when or where this was. All that mattered was this movement. Everything was fluid, and a specific meaning was born of that fluidity. But as she gave herself up to it, she found her body growing transparent. She could see through her hands to the other side. Her bones, organs, and womb became visible. At this rate, she might very well no longer exist. After she could no longer see herself, Aomame wondered what could possibly come then. She had no answer. At 2 p.m., the phone rang, and Aomame, dozing on the sofa, leapt to her feet. "Is everything going okay?" Tamaru asked. Yes, fine, Aomame replied.
How about the NHK fee collector?
I haven't seen him at all. Maybe he was just threatening me, saying he would be back.
Could be, Tamaru said. We set it up so the NHK subscription fee is automatically paid from a bank account, and an up-to-date sticker is on the door. Any fee collector would be bound to see it. We called NHK and they said the same thing. It must be some kind of clerical error.
I just hope I don't have to deal with him.
Yes, we need to avoid any kind of attention. And I don't like it when there are mistakes.
But the world is full of mistakes.
The world can be that way, but I have my own way of doing things,
Tamaru said.
If there is anything that bothers you, anything at all, make sure you get in touch.
Is there anything new with Sakigake?
Everything has been quiet. I imagine something is going on below the surface, but we can't tell from the outside.
I heard you had an informant within the organization.
We've gotten some reports, but they're focused on details, not the big picture. It does seem as if they are tightening up control of the faith. The faucet has been shut.
But they are definitely still after me.
Since Leader's death, there has clearly been a large gap left in the organization. They haven't decided yet who is going to succeed him or what sort of policy Sakigake should take. But when it comes to pursuing you, opinion is unwavering and unanimous. Those are the facts we have been able to find out.
Not very heartwarming facts, are they?
Well, with facts, what's important is their weight and accuracy. Warmth is secondary.
Anyway, Aomame said, if they capture me and the truth comes to light, that will be a problem for you as well.
That is why we want to get you to a place they can't reach, as soon as we can.
I know, but I need you to wait a little longer.
She said that we would wait until the end of the year. So of course that's what I'll do.
I appreciate it.
I'm not the one you should be thanking.
Be that as it may, Aomame said, there is one item I'd like to add to the list the next time you bring over supplies. It's hard to say this to a man, though.
I'm like a rock wall, Tamaru said. Plus, when it comes to being gay, I'm in the big leagues.
I would like a home pregnancy test. There was silence. Finally, Tamaru spoke.
You believe there is a need for that kind of test?
It wasn't a question, so Aomame didn't reply.
Do you think you might be pregnant?
Tamaru asked. No, that isn't the reason.
Tamaru quickly turned this over in his mind. If you were quiet, you could actually hear the wheels turning. You don't think you're pregnant, yet you need a pregnancy test.
That's right.
Sounds like a riddle to me.
All I can tell you is that I would like to have the test. The kind of simple home test you can pick up in a drugstore is fine. I'd also appreciate a handbook on the female body and menstruation.
Tamaru was silent once more. A hard, concentrated silence. I think it would be better if I called you back, he said. Is that okay?
Of course. He made a small sound in the back of his throat and hung up the phone. The phone rang again 15 minutes later. It had been a long while since Aomame had heard the dowager's voice. She felt like she was back in the greenhouse, that humid, warm space where rare butterflies flutter about and time passes slowly.
Are you doing all right there?
I'm trying to keep to a daily routine, Aomame replied. Since the dowager wanted to know, Aomame gave her a summary of her daily schedule, her exercising, and meals.
It must be hard for you, the dowager said, not being able to go outside. But you have a strong will, so I'm not worried about you. I know you will be able to get through it. I would like to have you leave there as soon as possible and get you to a safer place. But if you want to stay there longer, I will do what I can to honor your wishes.
I am grateful for that.
No, I'm the one who should be grateful to you. You have done a wonderful thing for us.
A short silence followed, and then the Dowager continued.
Now, I understand you have requested a pregnancy test.
My period is nearly 3 weeks late.
Are your periods usually regular?
Since they began when I was 10, I have had a period every 29 days, almost without fail. Like the waxing and waning of the moon, I've never skipped one.
You are in an unusual situation right now. Your emotional balance and physical rhythm will be thrown off. It's possible your period might stop, or the timing may be off.
It has never happened before, but I understand how it could.
According to Tamaru, you don't see how you could be pregnant.
The last time I had sexual relations with a man was the middle of June. After that, nothing at all.
Still, you suspect you might be pregnant. Is there any evidence for that, other than your period being late?
I just have a feeling about it.
A feeling?
A feeling inside me.
A feeling that you have conceived?
Once we talked about eggs, remember? The evening we went to see Tsubasa. About how women have a set number of them.
I remember. The average woman has about 400 eggs. Each month she releases one of them.
Well, I have the distinct sensation that one of those eggs has been fertilized. I don't know if sensation is the right word, though. The Dowager pondered this.
I have had 2 children, so I think I have a very good idea of what you mean by sensation. But you're saying you've been impregnated without having had sex with a man. That is a little difficult to accept.
I know. I feel the same way.
I'm sorry to have to ask this, but is it possible you've had sexual relations with someone while you weren't conscious?
That is not possible. My mind is always clear. The Dowager chose her words carefully.
I have always thought of you as a very calm, logical person.
I've always tried to be, Almamy said.
In spite of that, you think you are pregnant without having had sex.
I think that possibility exists, to put it more accurately, Almamy replied. Of course, it might not make any sense even to consider it.
I understand, the Dowager said. Let's wait and see what happens. The pregnancy kit will be there tomorrow. It will come at the same time and in the same way as the rest of the supplies. We will include several types of tests just to be sure.
I really appreciate it. Almamy said.
If it does turn out that you are pregnant, when do you think it happened?
I think it was that night when I went to the Hotel Okura. The night there was a storm. The Dowager gave a short sigh.
You can pinpoint it that clearly.
I calculated it, and that night just happened to be the day when I was most fertile.
Which would mean that you are 2 months along.
That's right, Almamy said.
Do you have any morning sickness? this would normally be when you would have the worst time of it.
No, I don't feel nauseous at all. I don't know why, though.
The Dowager took her time and carefully chose her next words.
If you do the test, and it does turn out you're pregnant, how do you think you'll react?
I suppose I'll try to figure out who the child's biological father could be. This would be very important to me.
But you have no idea.
Not at the moment, no.
I understand, the Dowager said calmly. At any rate, whatever does happen, I will always be with you. I'll do everything in my power to protect you. I want you to remember that.
I'm sorry to cause so much trouble at a time like this, Almama said.
It's no trouble at all, the Dowager said. This is the most important thing for a woman. Let's wait for the test results, and then decide what we'll do. Just relax.
And she quietly hung up. Someone knocked at the door. Almama was in the bedroom doing yoga, and she stopped and listened carefully. The knock was hard and insistent. She remembered that sound. She took the automatic pistol from the drawer and switched off the safety. She pulled back the slide to send a round into the chamber. She stuck the pistol in the back of her sweatpants and softly padded out to the dining room. She gripped the softball bat in both hands and stared at the door.
"Miss Takai!" a thick, hoarse voice called out. "Are you there, Miss Takai? NHK here. Come to collect the subscription fee."
Plastic tape was wrapped around the handle of the bat so it wouldn't slip.
"Miss Takai, to repeat myself, I know you're in there. So please stop playing this silly game of hide-and-seek. You're inside and you're listening to my voice."
The man was saying almost exactly the same things he had said the previous time, like a tape being replayed.
"I told you I would be back, but you probably thought that was just an empty threat. You should know that I always keep my promises. And if there are fees to collect, I most definitely will collect them. You're in there, Miss Takai. And you're listening. And you're thinking this. If I just stay patient, the collector will give up and go away."
He knocked on the door again for some time. 20, maybe 25 times.
"What sort of hands does this man have?" Almame wondered. "And why doesn't he use the doorbell?"
"And I know you're thinking this too," the fee collector said, as if reading her mind. "You are thinking that this man must have pretty tough hands, and that his hands must hurt pounding on the door like this so many times. And there is another thing you are thinking. Why in the world is he knocking anyway? There's a doorbell, so why not ring that?"
Almame grimaced. The fee collector continued.
"No, I don't want to ring the bell. If I do, all you hear is the bell ringing, that's all. No matter who pushes the bell, it makes the same harmless little sound. Now a knock, that has personality. You use your physical body to knock on something, and there is a flesh and blood emotion behind it. Of course my hand does hurt. I'm not Superman after all. But it can't be helped. This is my profession, and every profession, no matter high or low, deserves respect. Don't you agree, Miss Takai?"
Knox pounded on the door again. 27 in all. Powerful knocks with a fixed pause between each one.
Aomame's hands grew sweaty as they gripped the bat. Miss Takai! People who receive the NHK TV signal have to pay the fee. It's the law. There are no two ways about it. It is a rule we have to follow. So why don't you just cheerfully pay the fee? I'm not pounding on your door because I want to. And I know you don't want this unpleasantness to go on forever. You must be thinking, why do I have to go through this? So just cheerfully pay up. Then you can go back to your quiet life again.
The man's voice echoed loudly down the hallway. This man is enjoying the sound of his own voice, Aomame thought. He's getting a kick out of insulting people, making fun of them, and abusing them. She could sense the perverse pleasure he was getting from this.
You're quite the stubborn lady, aren't you, Miss Takai? I'm impressed. You're like a shellfish at the bottom of a deep ocean, maintaining a strict silence. But I know you're in there. You're there, glaring at me through the door. The tension is making your underarms sweat. Do I have that right?
13 more knocks. Then he stopped. Aomame realized she was indeed sweating under her arms.
All right. That's enough for today, but I'll be back soon. I'm starting to grow fond of this door. There are lots of doors in the world, and this one is not bad at all. It is definitely a door worth knocking on. At this rate, I won't be able to relax unless I drop by here regularly to give it a few good knocks. Goodbye, Miss Takai. I'll be back.
Silence reigned. The fee collector had apparently left for good, but she hadn't heard any footsteps. Maybe he was pretending to have left and was waiting outside the door. Aomame gripped the bat even tighter and waited a couple of minutes.
I'm still here, the fee collector suddenly announced. Ha! You thought I left, didn't you? But I'm still here. I lied. Sorry about that, Miss Takai. That's the sort of person I am.
She heard him cough, an intentionally grating cough.
I've been at this job for a long time, and over the years I've become able to picture the people on the other side of the door. This is the truth. Quite a few people hide behind their door and try to get away with not paying the NHK fee. I've been dealing with them for decades. Listen, Miss Takai.
He knocked 3 times, louder than he ever had.
Listen, Miss Takai. You're very clever at hiding, like a flounder on the seafloor covered in sand. Mimicry, they call it. But in the end, you won't be able to escape. Someone will come and open this door. You can count on it. As a veteran NHK fee collector, I guarantee it. You can hide as cleverly as you like, but in the final analysis, mimicry is deception, pure and simple. It doesn't solve a thing. It's true, Miss Takai. I'll be on my way soon. Don't worry this time for real. But I'll be back soon. When you hear a knock, you'll know it's me. Well, see you, Miss Takai. Take care.
She couldn't hear any footsteps this time either. She waited 5 minutes, then went up to the door and listened carefully. She squinted through the peephole. No one was outside. This time the fee collector really had left, it seemed. Aomame leaned the metal bat up against the kitchen counter. She slid the round out of the pistol's chamber, set the safety, wrapped it back up in a pair of thick tights, and returned it to the drawer. She lay down on the sofa and closed her eyes. The man's voice still rang in her ears.
But in the end, you won't be able to escape. Someone will come and open this door.
At least this man wasn't from Sakigake. They would take a quieter, more indirect approach. They would never yell in an apartment hallway, insinuate things like that, putting their target on guard. That was not their M.O. Almame pictured Buzzcut and Ponytail. They would sneak up on you without making a sound, and before you knew it, they would be standing right behind you. Almame shook her head and breathed quietly. Maybe he really was an NHK fee collector. If so, it was strange that he didn't notice the sticker that said they paid the subscription fee automatically. Almame had checked that the sticker was pasted to the side of the door. Maybe the man was a mental patient. But the things he said had a bit too much reality to them for that. The man certainly did seem to sense my presence on the other side of the door, as if he had sniffed out my secret, or part of it. But he did not have the power to open the door and come in. The door had to be opened from inside, and I'm not planning on opening it. No, she thought. It's hard to say that for sure. Someday I might open the door. If Tengo were to show up at the playground, I wouldn't hesitate to open the door and rush outside. It doesn't matter what might be waiting for me. Almame sank down into the garden chair on the balcony and gazed as usual through the cracks in the screen at the playground. A high school couple were sitting on the bench underneath the Zelkova tree, discussing something, serious expressions on their faces. Two young mothers were watching their children, not yet old enough for kindergarten, playing in the sandbox. They were deep in conversation, yet kept their eyes glued to their children. A typical afternoon scene in a park. Almame stared at the top of the slide for a long time. She brought her hand down to her abdomen, shut her eyes, and listened carefully, trying to pick up the voice. Something was definitely alive inside her. A small, living something. She knew it.
Dota,
she whispered.
Mother,
something replied.
Chapter 9. Tengo. Before the exit is blocked. The four of them had yakiniku, then went to another place where they sang karaoke and polished off a bottle of whiskey. It was nearly 10 p.m. when their cozy but boisterous little party broke up. After they left the bar, Tengo took Nurse Adachi back to her apartment. The other two women could catch a bus near the station, and they casually let things work out that way. Tengo and the young nurse walked down the deserted streets side by side for a quarter of an hour. "Tengo, Tengo, Tengo," she sang out. "Such a nice name. Tengo. It's so easy to say." Nurse Adachi had drunk a lot, but her cheeks were normally rosy, so it was hard to tell, just by looking at her face, how drunk she really was. Her words weren't slurred, and her footsteps were solid. She didn't seem drunk, though people had their own ways of being drunk. "I always thought it was a weird name," Tengo said. "It isn't at all. Tengo. It has a nice ring to it, and it's easy to remember. It's a wonderful name. Speaking of which, I don't know your first name. Everybody calls you Ku."
"That's my nickname. My real name is Kumi. Kind of a nothing name."
"Kumi Adachi," Tengo said aloud. "Not bad. Compact and simple."
"Thank you," Kumi Adachi said. "But putting it like that makes me feel like a Honda Civic or something."
"I meant it as a compliment."
"I know. I get good mileage, too," she said, and took Tengo's hand. "Do you mind if I hold your hand? It makes it more fun to walk together and more relaxed."
"I don't mind," Tengo replied. Holding hands like this with Kumi Adachi, he remembered Aomami and the classroom in elementary school. It felt different now, but there was something in common. "I must be a little drunk," Kumi said. You think so?
Yep.
Tango looked at the young nurse's face again. You don't look drunk.
I don't show it on the outside. That's just the way I am. But I'm wasted.
Well, you were knocking them back pretty steadily.
I know. I haven't drunk this much in a long time.
You just have to get out like this sometimes, Tango said, quoting Mrs. Tamura.
Of course, Kumi said, nodding vigorously. People have to get out sometimes, have something good to eat, have some drinks, belt out some songs, talk about nothing in particular. But I wonder if you ever have times like that, where you just get it out of your system to clear your head. You always seem so cool and composed, Tango.
Tango thought about it. Had he done anything lately to unwind? He couldn't recall. If he couldn't recall, that probably meant he hadn't. The whole concept of getting something out of his system was something he might be lacking.
Not so much, I guess, Tango admitted. Everybody's different. There are all sorts of ways of thinking and feeling.
Just like there are lots of ways of being drunk, the nurse said and giggled.
But it's important, Tango.
You may be right, he said. They walked on in silence for a while, hand in hand. Tango felt uneasy about the change in the way she spoke. When she had on her nurse's uniform, Kumi was invariably polite. But now, in civilian clothes, she was more outspoken, probably partly due to the alcohol. That informal way of talking reminded him of someone. Somebody had spoken the same way. Someone he had met fairly recently.
Tango, have you ever tried hashish?
Hashish.
Cannabis resin.
Tango breathed in the night air and exhaled. No, I never have.
How about trying some? Kumi Adachi asked. Let's try it together. I have some at home.
You have hashish.
Looks can be deceiving.
They certainly can, Tango said vaguely. So a healthy young nurse living in a seaside little town on the Bozo Peninsula had hashish in her apartment, and she was inviting him to smoke some. How did you get a hold of it? Tango asked.
A girlfriend from high school gave it to me for a birthday present last month. She had gone to India and brought it back.
Kumi began swinging Tengo's hand with her own in a wide arc. But there's a stiff penalty if you're caught smuggling pot into the country. The Japanese police are really strict about it. They have pot-sniffing dogs at the airports.
She's not the type to worry about little details, Kumi said. Anyhow, she got through customs okay. Would you like to try it? It's high-quality stuff, very potent. I checked into it, and medically speaking, there's nothing dangerous about it. I'm not saying it isn't habit-forming, but it's much milder than tobacco, alcohol, or cocaine. Law enforcement says it's addictive, but that's ridiculous. If you believe that, then pachinko is far more dangerous. You don't get a hangover, so I think it would be good for you to try it to blow off some steam.
Have you tried it yourself?
Of course. It was fun.
Fun, Tango repeated.
You'll understand if you try it, Kumi said, and giggled. Say, did you know, when Queen Victoria had menstrual cramps, she used to smoke marijuana to lessen the pain. Her court doctor actually prescribed it to her.
You're kidding.
It's true. I read it in a book.
Which book? Tango was about to ask, but decided it was too much trouble. That was as far as he wanted to go, picturing Queen Victoria having menstrual cramps. So how old were you on your birthday last month? Tango asked, changing subjects.
23. A full-fledged adult.
Of course, Tango said. He was already 30, but yet to have a sense of himself as an adult. It just felt to him like he had spent 30 years in the world.
My older sister is staying over tonight at her boyfriend's, so I'm by myself. So come on over. Don't be shy. I'm off duty tomorrow, so I can take it easy.
Tango searched for a reply. He liked this young nurse, and she seemed to like him, too. But she was inviting him to her place. He looked up at the sky, but it was covered with thick gray clouds, and he couldn't see the moons.
The other day, when my girlfriend and I smoked hashish, Kumi began. That was my first time, but it felt like my body was floating in the air. Not very high, just a couple of inches.
You know, floating at that height felt really good, like it was just right.
Plus, you won't hurt yourself if you fall.
Yeah, it's just the right height, so you can feel safe, like you're being protected.